Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this comes out. I tend to have a friend of mine once said that he only had one talk and he just sort of rehashed it every time he gave it, depending on what the subject was. And I feel a bit like that, really. So I'm going to sort of wind in gradually by reading you a couple of poems, and then I'll tell you a bit about them and try and excuse myself. So the first one is called Evolution, and it's by a woman called Rebecca Elson, who's sort of contemporary. We are survivors of immeasurable events flung upon some reach of land. Small wet miracles without instructions, only the imperative of change. So I like that. I think of that as a sort of transcendental principle poem, because it sort of describes the way things are in the big picture. And then this is another poem, which is a bit more down to earth in a way. This is by Philip Larkin. This be the verse. And I've amended it slightly so that I don't break the precepts. They mess you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were messed up in their turn by fools with old style hats and coats, who half the time were sloppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself. I must admit, when I first read this, it really resonated for me. But this doesn't mean that it's all your mum and dad's fault or your ancestors' fault. That's far too simplistic, and it's not what Buddhism teaches. Nor am I having a go at people with children and saying that you shouldn't have children if that's what you want to do. However, from my point of view, it's always seemed like bringing up children has always seemed to me to be an extremely responsible, expensive and time-consuming job of work. I think somebody described it once as 20 years hard labour. And it does complicate life. And one of Banti's axioms that I'm sort of very fond of sort of brings this in. I don't know why I've spent years thinking about this little axiom, but it seems to be very important to me. You can only live a simple life if you remember what life is really for. The purpose of simplicity is not to let the business of living get in the way of the things that are of importance. And that's from Pieces of Fire. I've got some more stuff on this, but I've always had a sort of hankering, I suppose, for simplicity. At times, the business of living, even a reasonably simple life at Padmaloka, can get in the way of the things that are of importance. And certainly, to some extent, I think being a private and public preceptor has made things quite complicated for me. And in some ways, it gets in the way of the things that are of importance. Now, what the things are that are of importance, one has to sort of work out for oneself, doesn't one? One has to sort of ask oneself, what is the meaning of life? And all those sort of questions. Again, they're big questions that I've always sort of been trying to sort of kick around in my mind. And I suppose they've sort of got in the way of me sort of wanting to sort of embark on a career or a family life. They've always sort of interposed, if I can sort those out, then maybe then I could have a career and maybe a family. That's what I used to think. I mean, they've sort of, both those sort of options have sort of faded way down the path now. I got a letter once from a friend of mine, somebody I privately ordained actually, who was a parent. And The gist of his letter was that he brought these two boys into the world, and they were in their teens, but he'd realised that mostly what he'd been doing for about the first 15 years was trying to sort of get to the end of the day without going under, kind of thing. It was all hands on deck. That's how he described it. coping from one crisis to the next and never really getting to a grip on the underlying causation, surviving it rather than addressing it. That's how he put it. And he realised that it was too late for his children, maybe his grandchildren. He thought, maybe I'll be able to, you know, sort of intersperse, my, you know, interpose myself into their lives, so that, you know, this sort of this crisis management isn't passed from one generation to another. So all this, I mean, basically, what all this points to for me and always has done is that we desperately need instructions. We ourselves, all sentient beings, the world needs instructions, and this is universal. We don't get many instructions unless we're very, very fortunate. We don't get them at school, and usually we don't get them from our parents because they haven't managed to sort it out either, as my friend sort of put it to me. And it doesn't matter where you come from. I mean, we've got a Swede, a couple of Germans, haven't we? We've got a South African, somebody from somewhere in Central Europe. Cardiff, yeah. We've got people from, we've got Celts, and various mongrel British. But we're all afflicted with this legacy of ignorance. We're all oppressed by the imperative of change. This is the human condition, and we all need instructions. As I said, we don't get these instructions at school. We need a certain kind of instruction, don't we? We don't need instructions, I don't think, from philosophy, psychology, ecology, and lots of other things. Interesting though these may be, and they may even be useful starting points to some extent. Obviously, if there's a hierarchy of needs. You don't give a starving man the Dharma. He needs to eat first, yeah? But given that, you know, somewhere down the line, this spiritual need, as we could call it, becomes very, very important. Another way of putting it is that our real needs are of ethical and spiritual nature, yeah? This word spiritual is quite interesting, isn't it? I don't know whether you... I mean, we sort of drop it off our tongues, but it's worth looking at Bhante's definition of spiritual. I haven't included it in this talk, but I mention it a couple of times. This word spiritual is not... it's not a sort of a word to be passed over lightly. It means something quite specific. In the survey, Bhante quotes... something from a Chinese source, and he says, living beings are unhappy because of their acts, because of their nature. It's impossible to make them happy by supplying them with merely material aid. The best way of helping them is to establish them in goodness. So in a way, that's partly what we need. That's the ethical basis. That's our ethical need. We need to be established in goodness, and then maybe other things can develop from there. Let's just have a look. So there's something of the Bodhisattva vow in our public ordination. Our order and movement was founded by Bhante as an attempt to answer this legacy of ignorance. To answer the human condition and to provide some instructions to those who are interested so that they can establish themselves in goodness, which is, as I say, the beginning of the real needs. Yeah. So the context for our movement really is the Bodhisattva ideal for the benefit of all. And this comes directly from Bhante and his own experience. I think he's always sort of been inspired by this, even from a young age. If you read his biographies, it's a matter of course in the Tibetan tradition. But for Bhante, it was very, very important because he took the Bodhisattva vow from Dado Rinpoche. Bhante, of course, considered Dado Rinpoche to be a living Bodhisattva, particularly through his work at the school in Kalimpong. Now, I know Bhante's a sort of, a sort of checkered character in some ways. He's done all sorts of things that we might argue with, but I don't think we can argue with his intense desire to and practice of communicating the Dharma. Yeah, whatever else he's done, he's been sort of tireless in doing that, and he's done it in quite incredible style at times in his career. I'm thinking particularly of his sort of passionate involvement in India after the mass conversions to Buddhism in the wake of Dr. Ambedkar and Dr. Ambedkar's subsequent death. And Banti he delivered a phenomenal number of talks to literally thousands and thousands of people in a very short space of time, something like 2 or 3 weeks, I think it was. And Banti was quite sort of, remarkable for this. I mean, as far as I know, not many other monks, Buddhist monks, sort of got involved with this. And even the ones that did wanted all sorts of special treatment. But if you read Banti's memoirs, he put up with all sorts of, desperate conditions, really, living conditions, just so that he could get this stuff across. He could get across to people what it meant to be a Buddhist and what it meant to answer the human condition. And I suppose, again, to try and provide some of these needs. So he's seriously committed to spreading the Dharma. He feels the world really needs the Dharma. He was asked to come to the United Kingdom, but he didn't particularly want to do that. It wasn't something he'd been thinking about. I think he would have preferred, this is what he says, he would have preferred to stay in India and just carry on with his writing and stuff. And he also considers himself not to be the best person to start a Buddhist movement. He's a very complex person, a mysterious person, I think. And he says of himself that he doesn't really sort of think of himself as having started the movement. Something started the order and the movement through him, what he calls a vast overreaching consciousness. And I find that quite inspiring, that sort of Banti has ended up doing something, well, that he didn't particularly think he was the best person to do and didn't particularly want to do. And you can also see a sort of a reflection of this in Dado Rinpoche's life. Dado Rinpoche, originally a high-ranking tulku, or certainly born one, didn't really feel like he was, realised that people wanted him to be a bodhisattva, although he didn't particularly feel like one, so he just decided to be one for other people. And then he thought he'd be a good monk and all the rest of it. But he ends up, teaching Tibetan orphans in a little school in Kalimpong, just because he doesn't want to get caught up in all the sort of, the politics and stuff that goes with a lot of Tibetan Buddhism. So, I like to think that we inherit some of this from Banti, and we inherit it from Dado Rinpoche. You've got the ordination team here, Padmavajra, Sadaloka, Satyaraja, Dharmadipa. We're not much to look at. We don't have a lot to offer, but here we are. The private and public preceptors, they're all sort of doing things, if they're anything like me, that they didn't particularly want to do. I know I certainly didn't. Things just sort of, you just end up doing these things because they're there to be done. So our order and movement is Mahayana in spirit. The altruistic dimension of going for refuge is not optional. Please try to remember that. Yeah, Banti includes it, I think, as one of the things that that marks the beginning of an order member's sort of downfall, is that they stop engaging in altruistic activity. We've got to be as active as we can in going out to others. As I say, once you get into sort of private life, this can become more and more limited. Like the Bodhisattva, we should be attempting to become more and more all things to all men. So when we're ordained into the Western Buddhist order, our ordination is accepted for the benefit of all beings. During the public ordination ceremony, after reciting the refuges and the 10 precepts and receiving the kesa, one recites the 4 acceptance verses or vows. And verses or vows, we talked about this in my group. it's quite interesting. Well, for myself, you know, well, are they verses or are they vows? It's not. It's sort of left open in a way, and I rather like that. Yeah, I like this sort of tension, not to say pressure, about the question: is it, you know, is it a verse or is it a vow? What makes a public statement of intention a vow? You know, interesting, very interesting. I think it sort of. I think one sort of responds to it depending upon, I suppose, one's degree of integration. And the more integrated you get, the more like a vow it becomes, perhaps. You could talk about that. There are all sorts of considerations that arise here, which I don't really have time to go into. For example, what is the nature and significance of a public ceremony? That's quite interesting. You know, you've got this public ceremony, and you recite these four lines. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So what is the nature and significance of making these statements? What is the nature and significance of a ritual act, if that's what it is? Do you see it as a ritual act, a ceremony? Quite interesting. There's a lot that could be said about that. Another consideration, which I'll go into briefly, is the question of duties. And we're coming up against some of those, aren't we, in the two sets of 15 points, whether it's explicitly put like that or not. When one enters the Western Buddhist order, there are all sorts of duties to fulfill. It's not just, you know, getting a kesa and a copy of Shabda once a month and, you know, sort of lording it with a bit of... you know, status. It's not really like that at all. There is no status. Yeah. Banti goes into the whole business of duties in a little essay called Rights and Duties, which he wrote a long time ago, although fortunately it's been republished in The Essential Sangha Akshita, page 610, if you're interested. And I'll sort of abridge it a little bit, because it is very interesting, an interesting little essay, and it had quite a profound effect on me when I read it. So he says that rights and duties are like the two ends of a walking stick. And when you pick up a walking stick, it's important to pick up the right end. Yeah, you can move from one end to the other, and the two ends are self and others. Yeah, those are the two ends of the walking stick. And he said it's important that you pick up the right end, not the wrong end. And the right end, of course, is others. It's not self. So he says that duties consist in what is due from us to others, and they're based upon giving, whereas rights consist in what is due from others to us, and are based from a subjective point of view upon grasping and getting. The performance of one's duty does not mean merely the grudging recognition and half-hearted rendering of what is legally or even morally due to one's family and friends, brackets perhaps spiritual friends even, social or national group, political party, religious organisation, etc., but in an unobstructed outward flow of one's love and compassion over the whole world. Further on, he says that the conscientious performance of one's duties results in the gradual loosening of the bonds of selfishness and egotism. The performance of one's duties results in the establishment of love and peace. The attempted extortion of one's rights results in the outbreak of hatred and violence. Duties unite, rights divide. Duties are cooperative, rights competitive. And then he adds this really nice little rider. But, some will protest, if we simply perform our duties without demanding our rights in return, we shall be taken advantage of and exploited by unscrupulous politicians and crooked capitalists. Order members and ordination team members, this is my little insert, public and private preceptors perhaps, might take advantage of us. We shall be abused and trampled upon by people on every side. This objection would be valid only if the performance of duty was envisaged as something which applied not to all sections of society, but only to some. But since the two ends of human relationship are as inseparable as the two ends of a stick, and since our rights become duties when looked at from the other end, and since no one will consider himself to be without rights, the performance of duties is an obligation which rests equally upon the shoulders of all men and from which none can escape. The remedy for any injustice or inequality in human relationships, whether domestic, social, civil, political, cultural, racial or religious, is not insistence upon the rights of one party, but on the duties of the other. The reminder of their duties appeals to all that is best and noblest in men and nations, to their innate selflessness and love. It's constructive and positive, and results in cooperation, harmony and peace. So do read that and think about it, because it's a really sort of striking little essay. Well, as many of Bounty's essays are, and as I say, the Essential Sangharakshita is full of all sorts of little gems, and they're quite, some of them are quite short things. I mean, you can literally read them in 10 or 15 minutes, so it's a diamond-studded volume. Where am I? Right. So for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So our ordination into the WBO, to come or in the past, is for the benefit of all beings. We go for refuge to the three jewels for the benefit of all beings. We're Dharmacharis, or Mitras who ask for ordination, for the benefit of all beings. Our life, our practice, is for the benefit of all beings, if we've got the time and we remember what's important. And really, this is not, as I said before, this is not an optional extra. And Bhante made this very, very clear in a question and answer session here at Padmaloka on the Bodhisattva ideal in 1986. And somebody said to him, asked him this question, "I'm under the impression that perhaps sometimes people are ordained without explicitly understanding the altruistic aspect of going for refuge, and it may take them quite some time to realise." This is the question. So Bhante said, "In a certain sense, you have to work on yourself quite a bit before you can genuinely and usefully help others. So perhaps it's not a bad thing that you come to realise the other regarding aspects or implications of the spiritual life, or of the going for refuge in particular, at a slightly later stage. But certainly you shouldn't be completely unaware of them. Don't forget those concluding words of the ordination ceremony. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination." I included that quite deliberately when I composed those verses, so the hint is there. Inasmuch as it comes last, that is the concluding emphasis. Perhaps more attention should be drawn to that. Perhaps we need to highlight that element more. And then the questioner went on, "Over the years, different aspects of going for refuge that weren't immediately apparent have been drawn out. Would you like to see us making this particular aspect more explicit?" And Bhante says, "Well, I would. I see the world as being in a very bad way and as really needing the Dharma. And I see it therefore as a duty, to use that unpopular term, of all the members, of those who are committed to the three jewels, to spread the Dharma as much as they can for the benefit of all beings, or as many as they can possibly reach. No order member should be left with the impression that being an order member just means being committed to your own personal development in a fairly easygoing, cosy, comfortable way. Not giving yourself too difficult a time, doing a bit of meditation, a bit of study, having a nice easygoing life in the country, maybe on the dole, not exerting yourself too much, not being too adventurous, not doing too much for other people. One doesn't want to encourage that sort of picture of the order member at all." So it really is part of our duty as an order member to contribute to what Bhante elsewhere calls the third order of consciousness. Yeah, and you'll find this, there's a description of all this in the New Voice in the Buddhist tradition. Bhante says effectively that having become aware of oneself as an individual, as independent of the group and having entered what he calls the second order of consciousness, having done that, one then finds oneself in relation to other individuals. This collective consciousness of the spiritual community is the third order of consciousness. There is no loss of individuality. In another place in Human Enlightenment, he says that it has no collective identity in which you lose your own or in which you become submerged. So there's this, I mean, you're probably all familiar with this, aren't you? There's this sort of paradox. You're part of a collection, but you don't lose your own individuality. Subhuti says, each member is fully and completely aware of himself, and there is no giving up of individual thoughts and feelings to the collective. Rather, individual thoughts and feelings coincide freely and spontaneously. Members of the spiritual community base their lives upon the same ideals and values and have the same perspective. There can be a coincidence of wills to such an extent that the notion of a separate self, isolated from others, is dissolved. Banti uses an analogy for this, which I've always found quite useful, and that's the analogy of an orchestra, which he says is a spiritual community, at least while it's playing. I don't know whether our musicians would agree with that or not. A fully functioning and vibrant spiritual community, again that word spiritual needs looking up and emphasising here, seems to be both an analogy for the bodhicitta and a necessary cause and condition for the arising of the bodhicitta. What is the bodhicitta? I think the bodhicitta is another unfathomable. And if you think you've fathomed it, you need to think again and look inside a bit. There are things that we can say about it. We can sort of define it, as it were, to some extent, in a conceptual sense. We can say that bodhi means particularly enlightenment, and that citta means heart-mind. Yeah, so you've got enlightenment, heart-mind. It's also described as the union of wisdom and compassion, or even the essence of wisdom and compassion, even the essence of emptiness and compassion. What's called in Sanskrit shunyata karuna garbha, which you might like to ask your group leader about if you don't know what that is. Traditionally, it's the arising of the bodhicitta that makes a bodhisattva a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva has compassion for all beings, and at the same time he knows that there are no beings. That's his wisdom. The emptiness, as it were, of all categories like being. So it's the emptiness of the skandhas, the sense organs, the objects of sense, ignorance, death, pain, wisdom, the attainment of wisdom, all the other stuff that we're so familiar with in the Heart Sutra. That's what the Heart Sutra is sort of pointing at. Now, this is a big topic, I know, and it can get very difficult and it can seem particularly esoteric. But there is a practical and easy way to approach all this without getting too, airy-fairy and metaphysical. And that's just to get rid of the ego, get rid of the self, or at least overcome the self. Learn to be unselfish. That's probably the bottom line, really. And this is ultimately for our own good, because it's part and parcel of the whole process of gaining insight, which is another way that we like to look at, progress on the spiritual path, isn't it? Let me just see whether I still think this is appropriate. This is a little bit, again, this is Banti on living with kindness on the Metta, particularly the Metta Sutta. Page 134, he says, a common misapprehension is to think of insight and egolessness in abstract, even metaphysical terms, rather than as comprising concretely lived attitudes and behaviour. But realising the truth of egolessness simply means being truly and deeply unselfish. To contemplate the principle of egolessness as some special principle that is somehow separate from our actual behaviour will leave it as far away as ever. If we find it difficult to realise the ultimate emptiness of the self, the solution is try to be a little less selfish. The understanding comes after the experience, not before. Which I think is a particularly good point. So again, how does one become unselfish? I think the first thing one has to do is to get positive. Yeah, I think it's vital. It becomes more obvious to me as I carry on practicing that whether or not I'm in a positive mental state is extremely important. Because if I try and do anything in a negative mental state, I get in a real mess, and I just get worse. Yeah, my own sort of my own mental state gets worse, and I spread my sort of negativity amongst other people. So the first thing I have to do is learn to recognise the difference between a negative mental state and a positive one, and know when I'm in the one and not the other. Yeah, and then if I am in a negative mental state, rein everything in and try not to act, try not to speak, try not to do too much, because then I tend to get in a mess. There are other ways of sort of looking at this as well. Having got in a positive mental state, you could try overcoming your likes and dislikes. Yeah, very often our ego identity, our sense of self, is completely caught up with a list of what we like and what we don't like. And we spend an awful lot of our time going around telling other people what we're like in terms of what we like and what we don't like. We sort of identify as, oh, I don't like this. You know, we tell other people, oh, I like this, you know, and I like that. Well, I don't like that. And we sort of share this with all our friends, don't we, on a regular basis. And that sort of turns us into this person, you know, this ego, this self, that is a particular kind of way. And we really need to sort of loosen that up as much as we can, so that we're not defined by our likes and dislikes. Otherwise, they just take over, and we find we get into a sort of habitual behaviour on the basis of them. And it becomes quite automatic. We don't have to be very conscious at all to do that. We almost become like an animal. You can also practice perversity. I'm afraid my group are probably bored to tears by this, because I've already talked about it a bit. Practicing perversity is, you have to do this quite gently and, with a certain amount of self-awareness. But you look at the things that you tend to do and you think, now, I wonder if I could do the opposite. What would happen if I just did the opposite of this? And I started doing this when I was in Brighton years ago, because I noticed that, you know, beginner's night, Wednesday night, the doors open, in flood all these new people that I've never seen before. And I'd sort of look around and I'd make a beeline for the youngest, most attractive looking woman. But I got terribly disappointed doing that. Very often they were quite vacuous. They certainly didn't live up to my expectations. So then I thought, OK, well, that doesn't work. Let's try the most attractive looking old woman. And that didn't work either. I was still disappointed. So I thought, let's try the most attractive looking young man. And even that didn't work, yeah, because again, I had expectations. So I started, I ended up by sort of, they'd all pour in and think, oh God, it's that one, isn't it? Yeah, okay. So I'd go over and I'd make a beeline for the person that I thought looked the most unpleasant. Do you know what I mean? The least attractive person that came through the door. And 9 times out of 10, I was really pleasantly surprised. I mean, it was remarkable the number of times this happened. There was another occasion where, I used to get a bit policeman-like, I'm afraid. I used to lead the regulars class, and I used to interview sort of relative beginners to find out, you know, what they were like with pooja, what their attitudes were like, before I'd actually let them into a regulars class. So one night I had these two people to sort of interview, so I interviewed them together. And there was this really tasty-looking young woman and this funny little old bloke with sort of, you know, bent glasses and crossed eyes, and a bit humped over. So I started talking about the pooja. You know, we'd be doing chanting and it's call and response. And this woman started to get all twitchy, this pretty-looking young woman started. And then she went red, and the guy was going, God, this sounds great, yeah. It's just what I want. So I let them both in, but she didn't last very long at all. She really didn't take to to Pooja. And, you know, I was expecting the opposite. You know, I really wasn't expecting very much of this poor little chap. And he carried on for quite a long time, actually. Hang on, where am I? practicing perversity, that's right. Yeah. Even giving a talk for me is a practice of perversity, I'll tell you, because I don't particularly enjoy doing it. Another way of doing this in a very practical way is just to try and develop equanimity. Yeah. Again, this is really, it's really sort of another way of looking at likes and dislikes. There are all sorts of little axioms that go with this. There's one by Pema Chodron that I like. Take whatever arises as the path. Yeah? So it's like, you know, anything that happens to you can be a teaching. Yeah, you can turn it into something that you can work with your Dharma practice. And there are all sorts of other sort of axioms like this from the greats. There's another one that I particularly like from Dilgo Kensei Rinpoche. And he says, the everyday practice is simply to develop a complete acceptance and openness to all situations and emotions and to all people, experiencing everything totally without mental reservations and blockages, so that one never withdraws or centralizes into oneself. It's a really sort of magnificent description of what goes on. Because that's what happens, isn't it? When we get in a situation where things aren't going our way, we sort of withdraw into ourselves and what we like and what we don't like. And we just become very, very subjective. What else have I got here? Another piece by Dilgo Kensei, he describes the Dharma practitioner as somebody who is able to handle all kinds of circumstances, both good and bad. One who can take even the worst experiences as catalysts to help further progress in his or her practice. So how we respond to the circumstances we're in reflects exactly the state of our practice. All difficulties are teachings. And again, this is Bante on a similar sort of thing. The whole process of the religious, spiritual or normative life is essentially nothing but a progressive attenuation of the ego sense. And any particular observance or practice, regardless of how sacred or profane it may outwardly seem, is to be judged useful insofar as it subserves, and useless and even positively harmful insofar as it does not subserve this process of attenuation. There's another little piece that I like from the Dalai Lama. He says that selflessness is not a case of something that existed in the past becoming non-existent. Rather, this sort of self is something that never did exist. What is needed is to identify as non-existent something that was always non-existent. And I think this is part of... This is why we need a simple life, yeah? This is why we have to watch out for getting caught up in the business of living. Because if we get caught up in the business of living, we can't see this difference. Yeah? We really can't see this at all. And I think often we do get a sense that you know, there's more going on here than just this, you know, catalogue of likes and dislikes, yeah. Bante himself says in Pieces of Fire, the one root illusion which prevents us from seeing things as they really are, and which it is the primary business of spiritual practice to remove, is the belief in ourselves as a separate, producing, individual self or ego entity. There's another little piece that I like. I mean, I'm sorry, I often trot this one out, but I rather like it because it challenges me as well. These are two lines from Edward Conza in Buddhist Thought in India. I'm a long-standing Buddhist, so if I'm convinced that there's no self, what and whom do I worry about? If I believe that there's only one vast emptiness, what is there to disturb my radiance? Why do I get so sort of uptight and out of it so much of the time, if that's what I really believe? Sort of interesting stuff, big questions. So it seems to be axiomatic that we cannot effectively attempt selflessness on our own. The bodhicitta, the essence of voidness and compassion, arises collectively in a spiritual community. Again, this word spiritual, yeah, look it up. Look, find out what Bhante actually means by spiritual community. But this is what Bhante's tried to set up. He's tried to set up a spiritual community. This is his life's work. This is why he's written his latest letter. And I know some people find the letter very controversial, but personally, I see it as a restatement of what Bhante's been saying all along. I mean, it's all the same old stuff. We need to stay in touch with ourselves, our spiritual friends. We need a specific teacher, specific methods of practice. We need to practice within supportive conditions, which is a big one, yeah? Again, that's another reason, I think, why all the members get in a state after ordination, is they overestimate their own abilities and they put themselves outside of supportive conditions. He says we need to become disciples in the fullest sense of the word. That's what he's implying. And I'd refer you to Ratnaguna and his little booklet, which is on sale in the foyer, on discipleship in the Western Buddhist order, and his latest update to that on from the last combined convention. He did a very nice, very short, just 20-minute talk updating his stuff on discipleship. So what all this means, I think, you know, what the letter means is, for me, and this is how I've always seen it, is becoming a Sangharakshita expert. Yeah, if I really think the man's got something to say, I should listen to everything he's said. I should read everything that he's written. I think you could see becoming a Bhante expert as an excellent ordination training. I mean, in a sense, that's what we try to do with the ordination process. The retreats that we put in on here is to plug you in to what Bhante has said and written. Yeah, you could see that as a really extended ordination training. Yeah, and if you're already ordained and you're wondering about post-ordination training, read Bhante, yeah? Have you read Bhante's writings? Have you read all of them? Have you read them over and over again? You know, once doesn't seem to be enough, in my experience. I told my group that very often older members, you know, new older members, they get ordained and then we don't see them for a couple of years. And they, by some fluke, they sort of come on a Going for Refuge retreat just to sort of test the water a bit. And after about a week, they say, God, I've remembered why I got ordained. Yeah, they've even forgotten why they've got ordained. So, you know, read that stuff. Yeah, read it over and over again. I had again, I talk about this all the time, so forgive me. But I had a sort of a very inspiring experience when I first came to Padmaloka 21 years ago. It was the first go at chapter one of the survey, and I think in the week leading up to the, you know, the start of the retreat, I went to Subhuti and I said, look, you've got me down as a study leader. I haven't read chapter one of the survey. He said, don't worry. He said, look, here's my notes. Take my notes away and you'll be fine along with the book. So, you know, I went in and I led this study group for 2 weeks on chapter one of the survey. And I had this remarkable experience because there was very little in chapter one of the survey that I hadn't come across before, and I'd heard it all from the mouths of older members, and I found that deeply inspiring, actually. But unfortunately, I don't think it happens so much now. I mean, I think 25 years ago, 30 years ago, when I was sort of newly ordained, everybody was talking about the same sort of stuff. Dharma was much more sort of in the air, I think, as a topic than it is these days. These days we've got all these extra sort of fancy bits that I mentioned before that seem to address our needs to some extent, but not fully, yeah. And they help a bit, and they're easy compared with the Dharma. So we tend to get sort of into them rather than getting into the Dharma. So don't let that happen, yeah. Be a somebody who can pour out what Bhante said and thought about anything at all. Yeah, learn it all, read it and learn it all. Become a Bhante expert and get rid of ego. That's our ordination training. That's our post-ordination training. And that's, it's perfectly clear from reading all of Banti's writings that that's what he wants us to do. So if we want to be loyal to our teachers, we must benefit all beings. If we want to be in harmony with friends and brethren, we must benefit all beings. And if we're aiming at the attainment of enlightenment, we must benefit all beings.